five. Five facts are all that you would ever need to defend the truth of the resurrection. This morning I want to look at them with you. And I want to go through the New Testament and discover how it is that we can determine and nail down what the facts really are. How do you know that we should be busy singing a song to Jesus Christ to make us more like Him? That song means nothing if He's still dead and in the ground. While we're on the subject, it might be helpful to point out that we should be able to defend our faith. I'd like to direct you to 1 Peter 3 and verse 15, where Peter writes to his audience, "Sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks you to give an account for the hope that is in you, yet with gentleness and reverence." Listen, if all you've got as to why you trust in Jesus Christ and in His resurrection is because mom and dad said so, or because you just feel that it's right, or because you like the story, or any other subjective criteria like that, just do yourself a favor and stay home tonight, because you're wasting your time in an assembly like this. This is designed to build up faith based on the evidence. We must be able and willing to give a defense, to explain rationally to people why we trust that Jesus is the Messiah. Can you do it? That's the purpose of our study today. By the way, I'm glad that you're here, and I don't want you to stay home tonight. You may want to after you hear me this morning, but I want to say, while I'm thinking about it, thank you for having me here. It is good to be back home. This is how this place feels to me. It's so good to be among so many of you that I've come to know and love and appreciate over the last several years. Your faith indeed is an encouragement to me. If you don't have anything more than facts, your faith is going to get destroyed. When you talk to a friend who is an atheist or a neighbor who is an agnostic, we have people who are in school, we have people here who are in college. If you don't know why you believe what you believe, other than what that's what the preacher has said for years and years, while you sat in assemblies like this, you're not going to be able to last very long. When someone poses some tough and challenging questions to your faith, that's why I want to focus on facts and not what you've heard before. And I don't want you to take my word for it either. John Adams is famous for having said that facts are stubborn things, and that's the beauty of them. They're impartial, they're not prejudiced, they're not biased, they just are what they are, and because they are what they are, they can withstand the most intense scrutiny. And if our faith is founded on facts, then you can stand up to the attacks of anyone, no matter how learned they might seem, no matter how intent they are to destroy your faith. Even no matter how intense persecution may arise from without, like we talked about in our Bible class. I have another passage on the screen. That's 1 Corinthians 15. Please look over there. In 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 14, by the way, in this chapter, Paul is talking about the resurrection. He's not talking so much about the truth of the resurrection. He's discussing another facet of it. But it's interesting to me that he says in verse 14, "If Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is vain. Your faith also is vain." In other words, if it's not true, don't waste your time with it, because it's not of any value to you or anybody else. Now, whether or not it is true is going to make all the difference. Whether or not it is true means that I have a good reason to face the trials and hardships of life with faith and hope. I have a reason to love my brethren, to love my enemy. And as we said earlier, we're not wasting our time here in moments like these. When it comes to the resurrection, we need to know the facts. And that's what I want to revisit with you today. That's what we need to focus our attention on. I want to say that the five facts that I've selected were selected based on two criteria. One of them is, of course, there is a lot of historical evidence that would support them. But the second thing is, they are widely accepted by a majority of religious scholars. Now, I'm not trying to base your faith on majority opinion, and I don't want to do that for myself. But what I'm saying is the evidence is so strong that even if they are considered a liberal who might be the type of person to say that Jesus didn't say everything that the four Gospels say that He said, they would at least agree that these five facts are the facts indeed, and there's nothing you can do to change it. That's the strength and the quality of the evidence that we have before us. So with nothing else, let's talk about the first thing that we have. You ready for this one? Because there's about a billion people in the world, give or take, at least, who would deny the first fact. Jesus was killed by crucifixion. Jesus was killed by crucifixion. That is a hard, fast rule. How do you know that that's the case? I suppose that you could do a number of things to find out whether or not that was true. But what I want to start off with is just by looking at some of the things that the Gospels themselves reveal to us about Jesus. You know, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 3 that the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, not in those exact words, was given to his audience at Corinth as being of first importance. This should be of first importance to us as well. This should be the foundation of our faith. This should be what we lead with when we teach other people about Jesus Christ and about salvation in his name. But how do you know it's true? You got four books in your New Testament that all tell the story of Jesus Christ. The thing about those four books that's interesting to me is that they don't always tell the same things. You know, only two of them say anything about when Jesus was born. And then we've got one that has a lot of dialogues that Jesus had with people that the other three don't even mention. And because some of them read a little bit differently in some ways, some of these skeptics that we talked about would like you to believe that you can't trust them, that they're contradictory, and that Matthew doesn't agree with Luke, and Luke doesn't agree with John, and so on and so on. It may be the case that they don't all tell you the exact same thing, but if there is one thing that they all agree on 100%, it's that Jesus died by crucifixion. Matthew 27:35 says that Jesus was crucified. Same thing in Mark 15:24. Same exact thing in Luke 25:33. And again in John 19:18. Even if you accept the fact, or at least the theory, that these people can't be trusted on every single thing that they tell you about Jesus Christ, you have to at least be open enough to acknowledge that they all agree when it comes to the manner in which Jesus was put to death. That's not all that we've got. Early Christians weren't the only ones reporting as to the nature of Jesus' death. You've got a guy like Tacitus. This was a Roman historian and senator, around 116 AD, he said that Jesus received the extreme penalty, which was a euphemism for the torturous agony that you endured when you were crucified. He said that Jesus received this penalty at the hand of Pilate. We've also got another guy named Josephus, who's probably pretty familiar to most of you, first century Jewish historian, born and lived towards the latter half of the first century. He said that Pilate condemned Jesus to the cross. What's interesting about Josephus is he has no interest in maintaining a supposedly fraudulent story like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John might have if they were trying to hoodwink everybody, because he wasn't a Christian. And yet he's agreeing with the very premise that we're starting out with, that Jesus died by crucifixion. We've also got Lucian, a Greek satirist, a mocker of Christians. He said that Jesus was crucified. Again, this guy is not a friend. He would not be sitting in an assembly like this with us. He would make fun of people like us. But he says that Jesus died by crucifixion. We have another person, Mara Bar Serapion, around 73 AD. That's only, what, 30, 40 years after Jesus went to the cross? That's pretty early. That's well within a time frame to bypass any legends or false stories that could arise about what happened to Jesus. He said the wise king of the Jews, that would be Jesus, that he's talking about, was executed. And then finally, even the Talmud, which was a Jewish commentary on the law, said that Jesus was hanged. Look with me in Galatians chapter 3. What does this mean, this idea of being hanged? In the old law, one of the penalties that people received was being hanged upon a tree. And Paul, who was Jewish and who was familiar with this expression, he was familiar with its usage in Deuteronomy, he uses this in a discourse about Jesus Christ. And he takes this imagery and he applies it to the manner in which Jesus died. He says in Galatians 3 and verse 13, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law, having become a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. Now, we just read from 1 Corinthians 15 earlier. Don't think Paul doesn't know what he's talking about, that he didn't get his story straight. He knows that Jesus went to the cross. He knows that he died. But he's taking the language of Deuteronomy and he's applying it to what happened to Jesus. And now we have confirmation from this same imagery that the Talmud also agrees. Jesus died by crucifixion. But so what? Somebody might ask you, couldn't Jesus have survived what he went through? Isn't it possible to live through being crucified? I personally kind of doubt that. I mean, after all, you've got Roman soldiers, at least four of them, from John 19:23, standing around there. Murder and execution was their business by trade. I would tend to think that they would be qualified to know whether or not someone was dead. And if they didn't get it right, I'm sure they could figure out a way to make sure that it did happen. A better question, I think, to ask would be this. Is it possible for anyone to fake slowly suffocating to death in front of your enemies who wanted to make sure that you were good and dead when there was no shred of evidence to even use credibly against you? That's a much better question to put forward. And if you can't fake it, then it must have really happened. Facts are stubborn things, and our first fact is that Jesus was killed by crucifixion. But that's not all we got. We got five of them, and that's just one. Secondly, Jesus' disciples believed that he arose and appeared to them. You may notice that it does not say that Jesus did rise and appear. That's not our fact. We're not putting that forward as our fact, because if you say, well, Jesus did rise up and appear to the disciples, the atheist will deny that. But one thing the atheist can't deny is that the disciples believe they actually saw him. You can't get around that. You can't get around it because that's what they say and that's what they wrote. An atheist would be foolish to dispute the second fact. It's undeniably clear. They at least thought that he showed up to them. If you're still in the book of Galatians, look in chapter 1. How do we know that they believe that he rose and appeared to them? First of all, we know that they believed it because Paul himself confirmed it. Paul says in Galatians 1 and verse 18, 3 years I went up to Jerusalem to become acquainted with Cephas, a.k.a. Peter, and stayed with him 15 days. Paul was on a first-name basis with these men who became Jesus' closest disciples during his ministry, who are revealed to us at the end of all four Gospels to have actually seen the man, to have touched him, and to have felt him. He knew what they believed. He knew what they taught. He wrote down what they said. He confirmed it. He agreed with it. This man would have been qualified to testify as to what these men believed about Jesus Christ and about his appearing to them. We also know because of other evidence we have in our New Testament, the gospel was at first an oral tradition, and we have a record of what they taught by mouth. You may remember in Acts chapter 2 and in verse 32. Acts 2 and verse 32. Peter says during his sermon, "This Jesus God raised up again, to which we are all witnesses." He didn't write those words, but we have a copy, a reliable copy of what he said from within the first century, telling us that from the earliest foundations of Christianity, these men believed that Jesus came back and appeared to them. But we also have it from their own mouth. Look with me in 1 John. I know this church just did a study of 1 John, and in the prologue of John's letter, the first four verses, he tells you why it is that you should even pay attention to what this guy has to say. This man is credible. He says in 1 John chapter 1 and verse 1, "What was from the beginning, what we have heard, what we have seen with our eyes, what we have looked at and touched with our hands concerning the word of life." This would be the manifest of Jesus Christ. Let's assume for a minute that you're not a believer. That's okay. Maybe you don't think that he's telling the truth. That's fine. But what you can't get around is that he at least believed it was true. That's what we're trying to prove here. He said the life was manifested, and we have seen and testify and proclaim to you the eternal life, which was with the Father and was manifested to us. What we have seen and heard, we proclaim to you also, so that you too may have fellowship with us. And indeed, our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. They believed it was true. That is a stubborn fact that we can't get around. But to me, the fact that they say that he appeared to them after he died is not even the strongest convincing evidence to me that this is indeed the fact of the case. What makes it more powerful to me is when you consider what these men were like when Jesus was being taken away to the cross. Look with me in Mark 14. In Mark chapter 14, we have Mark's record of Jesus being arrested in the garden. You may remember that this is not the most flattering moment or depiction of the faith of the disciples. Mark says very simply in Mark chapter 14 and verse 50, they all left him and fled. This is after Peter stood there and said, "Look, I'm willing to die with you. Everybody else can run off and abandon you, Lord, but I'm going to stand right here. I'm with you. I've got your back 100%. Mark says they all turned tail and ran. Not a high point. By the way, how would you even know that this story was true? That these men did abandon Jesus when he needed them most? What about verses 51 and 52? Might that be any evidence that this is a true account? Mark says, somewhat randomly, a young man was following him, wearing nothing but a linen sheet over his naked body, and they seized him. But he pulled free of the linen sheet and escaped naked. What am I supposed to do with that? There's a lot in our Bible that I wish I could make more sense of. And I don't really know why this one detail has been put in here when there's so much more stuff I would like to know about Jesus Christ. But I got to tell you, one thing that this strange story tells me when I see it right here in this text is that this must have been an eyewitness account. How else would you know that something like this occurred unless somebody had actually been there in the garden with Jesus when he was betrayed and arrested? Maybe it came from Peter himself, verse 54. Peter had followed him at a distance. Either way, the disciples, by way of the Gospels, we know, abandoned Jesus Christ. They were at their weakest right here. But in the book of Acts, they are not only willing to die, but some of them do. Why the difference? How do you account for that? How do you account from a 180 turn? This was a public and embarrassing betrayal of Jesus Christ, the most famous man in Judea. How do you go from that to putting it all on the line and giving it all? All I'm asking is, what's the most rational explanation for it? The only one that I can think of, and the only one available to us, is that the disciples believed that Jesus came back and appeared to them. Now, somebody might ask, and it's a good question, by the way, what does that prove? Aren't other people willing to die for their beliefs? What's so special about this? I mean, don't Muslims die because of what they believe? That's a perfectly good question. And I wouldn't base my proof that this must be a true story or even a fact only on their belief. But here's the difference. First of all, men don't die for what they know is a lie. And many times when you talk to people who say that this didn't actually happen, they want you to think that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, if they even wrote those books, and other people like Peter, James, and John, all sort of sat in a room and conspired and made the story up, and they made it so good and so clever that it hoodwinked thousands, millions of people over thousands of years. I don't believe that. If these men were lying, they would have known they were lying. And if these men were lying, they were idiots. Because they died for what they knew to be a lie. Secondly, the difference between the apostles and a jihadist is this. An apostle was actually in a position to know whether or not his beliefs were true. An apostle was able to actually touch Jesus Christ. We have a song in our hymn book here, Thomas's song. You can read about Thomas's account in John chapter 20. He says, I'm not going to believe it unless I can put my hand in his sides, unless I see him for myself. I'm just not going to believe what everybody else is telling me, that he really came back. These men were in a situation unique in history to know whether or not their faith had been misplaced. And according to them, they weren't just dying for their belief in the resurrection. They were dying for the truth of the resurrection. That's how they saw it anyway. Facts are stubborn things, and the fact of the case is Jesus' disciples believed he arose and appeared to them. That's just the first two. What about this one, though? To me, this is one of the most convincing evidences you can give for the truth of the resurrection. The conversion of the church persecutor, Paul, by his own hand and by the hand of others. We know that this man was a violent antagonist of the early church. I've got one reference I want to read with you. That's in 1 Timothy chapter 1. In verse 13, in 1 Timothy 1 and verse 13, he condemns himself by saying, I was formerly a blasphemer and a persecutor and a violent aggressor. This man is telling you point blank, I was not Jesus' BFF. I was not a fan of his disciples. I rounded them up. We discussed some of the things that he did in our Bible class today. Yet this man changed. This man wrote 1 Corinthians chapter 15. This man wrote the majority of our New Testament. This man says in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 8, by the way, very similar to what we just talked about a minute ago, that Jesus appeared to him also. You can read about that in Acts chapter 9. This man says, I was an eyewitness of the resurrected Lord, the very man that I stood against and tried to end, the man that I opposed the followers of intensely, violently. Why'd he do it? He had nothing to gain materially. Paul makes it clear in Philippians 3. He gave it all up. Every single fleshly advantage that he had, it was rubbish to him. And you know, Paul was Jewish. And just like you do, Jews believed in hell. They also believed in a thing called false doctrine. And Paul would have known as a Jew that if he got it wrong about Jesus Christ, he was running the risk of going to hell for eternity. Why does a man turn his back on 1,500 years of tradition of believing in God, believing that Moses was his prophet? Why does he do it? More importantly, how can you explain 2 Corinthians chapter 11? How can you make any sense of that? Look in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 23. Paul is speaking about all the hardships that he's endured because of his service, for his service. In far more labors, and far more imprisonments, beaten times without number, often in danger of death. 5 times I received from the Jews 39 lashes. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned and left for dead, by the way. 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I've spent in the deep. Why does a man do that? Paul was no dummy. He knew that from the moment he decided to convert to Christianity, he was going to throw himself into the mercy of the very same persecution that he helped whip up. Why does a man do that? Unless something can explain it rationally, incontrovertibly. Facts are stubborn things. The conversion of church persecutor Paul is one fact that skeptics just cannot get around. While we're talking about conversions, how about this one? If you were to ask somebody, if you were to call up a witness in a courtroom, what kind of people would you want to witness to someone's character, to witness to someone's most intimate secrets and how they are in life and how they conduct themselves? Would you want somebody that they spent one afternoon with at a restaurant? What if you had a brother? What if you had somebody who grew up in the same household, who sat at the feet of the same parents? What if you had a guy like James? Jesus' half-brother, who was a noted skeptic. In John chapter 7, we read of Jesus' brothers. In John chapter 7 and verse 3, John informs us of some advice that they give their brother. Therefore, his brother said to him, "Leave here and go into Judea, so that your disciples also may see your works which you are doing. For no one does anything in secret when he himself seeks to be known publicly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." That's not a statement of endorsement. John tells us, if there's any doubt, in verse 5, not even his brothers were believing in him. One such brother is told to us in Mark 6 and verse 3 would be a man named James. The same man, Paul says, he came to know while he was at Jerusalem in Galatians 1:19. James, the Lord's brother. We know for a fact that this man was a skeptical sibling. But later on, he became a suffering servant. How do you account for that? I would like to know more about James. I would like to know why it is that if he grew up with Jesus Christ, that he did not come to believe in Jesus. And evidently, not even after some time. I mean, who is it that Jesus entrusts the care of his mother to at the cross? Where are his brothers? He gives her to John. He's not even on board then, evidently. You know, I guess there's no way of being able to be certain why it is that James was not a believer. We know there was a lot of pressure in the Jewish community. They interpreted monotheism to mean that God could never take on human flesh. People were too embarrassed to speak out for their faith in Christ for fear of being thrown into the synagogue. But at some point, James was no longer embarrassed. Look in James chapter 1. It's believed that Jesus' half-brother wrote this short book. And in James chapter 1 and verse 2, James writes something very pertinent to their age. I guess everybody in here is familiar with trial of some sort. But if you ever faced violent persecution and oppression because of your faith, if we have faced such opposition, I don't feel uncomfortable saying that it's probably never been as intense as what these people put up with. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And let endurance have its perfect result, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. That's a different man. This is not the man who said, Why don't you go and show yourself to the world if you're really doing these signs? Chapter 2 and in verse 1, he refers to our glorious Lord Jesus Christ, his half-brother. Now he's calling him my God. In 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 7, when Paul gives a breakdown of people that Jesus appeared to after he resurrected, he says he appeared to James. Paul never says explicitly that this is the same James. He never says that it is Jesus' half-brother. But if it is, man, that sure would account for it, right? Another 180 turn, taking somebody who from childhood knew Jesus better than most ever would have hoped to. At some point in his life, even though he grew up with Jesus, didn't believe in him. And then later on decided not just to believe in him, but to preach about him and to lead others and to write things about him and to encourage other people to suffer for him. How do you explain it? Perhaps at the very least we could say, just like fact number two, James, just like the disciples, believed that Jesus arose and appeared to him. Facts are stubborn things. One more. How many times do you think about the empty tomb? There's a lot that I could think about regarding Jesus that could impress me. So many of his miracles just astound me. I can't explain them. I never will be able to. When I think about the empty tomb, it fills me with assurance, conviction, and hope. You know, it's been empty for 2,000 years. For 2,000 years, people try to put him back in there. But the genie's out of the bottle, so to speak. And you're not going to be able to do it. How do you know, though, that the tomb was empty? How do you know that it's been empty for 2,000 years? Very simple to establish that. First of all, there's the thing called the Jerusalem factor. What city was Jesus hung in? Jerusalem, right? What city in Acts chapter 2 are Peter and the rest of the apostles preaching in for the very first time that Jesus will save you from your sins? Jerusalem. If Peter, Andrew, James, and John, and all the rest of them had been lying, again, they were idiots. Because they're telling people, Jesus went to the cross, Jesus died, Jesus was buried. Where again, Peter? Oh, in Jerusalem. Well, if I'm not telling the truth, if Jesus was not really buried in Jerusalem, and if Jesus' tomb is not really empty in Jerusalem, I can fact check that pretty easy. I don't know how far away the tomb might have been from me in Jerusalem while I'm celebrating the Feast of Pentecost, but it couldn't have been more than a day's walk, right? To get to where you need to go to see if the tomb was in fact empty. If the story wasn't true, these men were just foolish to tell people in Jerusalem that it was. Secondly, we have something that's called enemy attestation. Look with me in Matthew chapter 28. In Matthew chapter 28, we have some other evidence that lets us know that the tomb was empty. We're not reading of a testimony that people believed it was empty. We're actually going to read about a conspiracy. In Matthew chapter 28 and verse 11, while they were on their way, some of the guard came into the city and reported to the chief priests all that had happened. And when they had assembled with the elders and consulted together, they gave a large sum of money to the soldiers. We would call that a bribe. They said, "You are to say, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep." What is that but an implicit admission that the tomb was empty? This is not Peter and James talking here. And if this should come to the governor's ears, we will win him over and keep you out of trouble. They took the money and did as they had been instructed, and this story was widely spread among the Jews and is to this day. I don't know when Matthew was written, maybe 40 AD, maybe just a few years before 70 AD, maybe 67 AD. That sounds good. Let's just go with that. If it had been told since by then, that means for three decades or so, the Jews have been telling people, not overtly, that the tomb was empty. Yeah, they want people to think that the disciples came along and stole it out of there while the guards were asleep, but they're still admitting that it was empty. One more thing. When Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John decided to tell their readers at the end of their books that the tomb was empty, Who finds out first? Women. Women were not highly regarded in their testimony as a general rule in the society of the first century. They were held in contempt, regarding legal matters. They were not considered to be credible witnesses. And yet Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all say that women are the first ones to find the tomb empty. Now again, if these men were lying, they are not going to come up with something that would embarrass them. And in Jewish society, in Greek society, in Roman society, to say that a woman's testimony is partially what you're founding your claim to faith in, that would be an embarrassment to a lot of people, and you wouldn't do it unless you were telling the truth. Fact is, Jesus' tomb was empty. Facts are stubborn things. And the tomb has stubbornly resisted being filled up for 2,000 years. So what? These are our facts. Jesus was killed by crucifixion. Jesus' disciples believed that he rose and appeared to them. The conversion of Paul, the church persecutor. The conversion of the skeptic James, Jesus' half-brother. And finally, the empty tomb. These are the facts. I'm sad to say the facts alone are not going to convince people that you want to go to heaven who have yet to give their lives to the Lord. Not by themselves, they won't. Because you know, at the end of the day, we still have to do something with these facts. We still have to interpret them. We have to reach a conclusion about them. And they're only going to convince a rational mind and an honest heart. So even though you may have a loved one in your family who is not a Christian, I can't make any promises that these five facts are going to be enough to sway them. But I can tell you what they do for me. When I look at the evidence and when I try to think about what's the only honest way, what's the only consistent way, what's the only reasonable way to explain these five facts? I mean, how am I supposed to account for them? How am I supposed to say that all these things happen without coming to the one conclusion that I am compelled to reach? And that is simply that Jesus Christ did rise up from the dead. You can't get around it. What other conclusion can you walk away from but that? When I look at these five facts, I'm reminded of something that Paul says in Romans chapter 1 and verse 4. Jesus Christ was declared to be the Son of God with power by the resurrection from the dead. Feeding 5,000 people, that was pretty neat. Walking on water, pretty cool. Raising Lazarus from the dead, I'm convinced. But that's not the miracle that Paul appeals to here. The greatest one that Jesus did was raising himself up from the dead. Peter says in Acts 2 and verse 36, therefore, let all the house of Israel kind of know. No, he says, know for certain that God has made him both Lord and Christ. This Jesus whom you crucified, he's back. He's not in the ground. The tomb is empty. Paul himself says in Acts 17 and verse 30, therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, God is now declaring to men that all people everywhere should repent, because he has fixed the day in which he will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom he has appointed, having furnished proof to all men by raising him from the dead. I guess for us, the prophecies may not be the most convincing thing out there. We didn't grow up with them as Jews. But the resurrection is the cornerstone. It is the summit. It is the pinnacle of evidence that Jesus is the Christ. Paul says in his sermon in Acts 17 that not only did Jesus rise from the dead, but he's coming back. There's going to be a judgment. How do you know that? I've never seen the judgment day. God didn't appear to me in some vision. He doesn't whisper to me that he's coming back or anything like that in my ear when I'm asleep at night. The only way that you know that it's going to happen is because Jesus is not in the ground anymore. You know it's going to happen because Jesus has gone back to heaven to be with the Lord. He's reigning now to offer propitiation and atonement and forgiveness. Maybe there's some people in this audience who haven't come to the conclusion they need to about the evidence. Maybe this wasn't enough to sway you. I'd love to talk with you some more, and I'm sure there are other people here that would too. But what if it did? It's not just a nice feel-good story. It's not just something that you're supposed to say, okay, well, I guess that is true. I guess it's more true than other religions I could believe in. This is practical. This is about saving your soul. For the people that have already committed to Christ, I hope this was faith-building. I hope we can use this to safeguard ourselves from the attacks of skeptics. But if you haven't repented, you are wasting your time. You can either crown Him Lord of your heart now, or you can do it in bitterness and judgment. For those of us that have given our lives to Him, we need to be strong and courageous. We need to be steadfast and immovable. That's what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15. This is how he wraps up his talk about the resurrection. He was writing this to a group of people that were Christians, but they struggled in some of their faith and in the applications and the results that should have been drawn from it. He says in verse 58 of 1 Corinthians 15, "Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your toil is not in vain in the Lord." Is that you? Is that me? We need to decide. We need to decide what we're going to do with Jesus based on the evidence. And if we reach the right conclusion, we need to decide what He's going to mean to us in the way we live our lives. If you need assistance with your soul this morning, whether you need encouragement to be steadfast and immovable, or if you need to give your heart to Him for the first time, this is a church of servants. I know they would love to help you. We all would. Why don't you make your need known to us together as we stand and sing?